This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Light a tea and let it be. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by, and big thanks to, Humboldt Patient Resource Center, Eco Groovy Deals, Sensa Valley, and the Humboldt County Collective. Thanks. We couldn't do it without you. Legal cannabis is a multi-lane emerging business. There's cultivation, retail, lab testing, transportation, edibles, concentrates, accountants, attorneys, and more. There are lots of rules and regulations. It's fast-moving, people coming and going all the time. What lane do you want to be in? What lane should you be in if all you want to do is get from point A to point B to point C and make the business work for you? Let me throw in a couple of twists. First, it's not easy to change lanes. It's possible, but it can be difficult and expensive. Second, this is an industry that is still under construction. There's no universally agreed upon master plan. You don't even know for sure whether this business will ultimately stretch all the way across the country or globe or not. How much risk are you comfortable with? Do you want to keep going? In this hour, we'll be talking with people who are in it for the long haul. We'll be visiting with Sisu Extracts, Papa and Barkley, and the Humboldt Patient Resource Center. As Arcata's first licensed dispensary under the Prop 215 regime, the Humboldt Patient Resource Center, or HPRC, has been providing cannabis products to the public since 1999. The transition to a legalized recreational environment brought about changes to HPRC's revenue stream, as well as the ways in which HPRC can invest those revenues. Here's HPRC General Manager Brian Wilcombe.
Our business is a not-for-profit mutual benefit corporation, and so when we were operating under Prop 215, we had a lot of reinvestment into the community, direct reinvestment. With bringing in the excise tax structure, the 15% excise tax really damaged our local contributions. What I mean by that is when we had excess revenues available, we directly reinvested them into the community, to where now those revenues were actually going in taxes out to the state level. So that was a big shock just, you know, when that first tax bill comes in and you're actually crunching your numbers saying, oh my gosh, it's great to support the system, if you will, to try to let the industry come out of its adoption phase here. But at the same time, those were local cash flows that went back into the community. And so that was a big shock for us. HPRC has operated a program called the Compassion Program for over a decade. And that program allowed us to donate cannabis to low-income and terminally ill patients. That program no longer is able to operate in the same capacity that we have been able to in the past. So that is a direct impact to local community members, because for those individuals, their low-income situation may have them making a choice to, do I afford the medicine that is allowing me to eat, or do I keep that money for food? And those were very difficult decisions, and so we were in a wonderful position to be able to offer assistance there. With the excessive tax rate, we are no longer able to offer that simply because the revenue that was available for the direct community reinvestment is absorbed through the taxation. So we do invest in other ways now. We are currently investing through our community wellness center, The Connection HPRC, and it's able to operate the way it is because our service providers also donate portions of their time too. They agree on a lowered rate for their services, which are high-valued services, because these individuals really do support that community-oriented cannabis culture.
In addition to changes in revenue, the emergence of the recreational market brought in a new type of customer with different levels of product knowledge and different consumer demands as compared to the medical client.
We spent a lot of time and invested a lot of money into certain types of laboratory testing to deliver all the information that we could about our product lines. So specifically terpene testing, to where we had to educate our staff and our consumers on how important the aromatic compounds were to the effectiveness of cannabis products. The new recreational customer is not educated on some of the different testing metrics made available, and the way that they shop is different. Recreational customers started to ask just for higher potency THC. We have extensive knowledge that it's not just about THC. So that was a big change for the staff. And, you know, I have a suitable product. It matches up to the request of the customer, but they're actually not interested in it because they perceive it as being too low THC and not having as much value as it actually has.
I see.
So over time, it's difficult to work then with long-standing farmers who cultivate outstanding products but don't hit this one performance metric, which is THC, and then they're really having a difficult chance getting a foothold into the marketplace in the recreational market. It becomes so focused on just high THC.
During this period of transition, rapid and unpredictable changes in regulatory requirements posed an especially difficult challenge to the retail lane in the cannabis business. Here once again is HPRC General Manager Brian Wilcombe.
Well, it's very difficult at the retail level to react to changes that can really mess up your intermediate and long-term planning. An example might be if I have to order packaging, and that packaging might take several weeks in design, coordinating large, we're talking tens of thousands of units of packaging to be purchased. If there's a rule change during that order time to production to shipping, and now you're stuck with 50,000 non-compliant jars. An example of that might be the child-proof packaging. In the regulation, out of the regulation, in the regulation, out of the regulation, back in. So there's been a lot of, unfortunately, malinvestment to where we have to pull the trigger in order to be compliant with timely decisions, and then within that timely decision, a rule would change. And it's really difficult too, because being a company that's trying to deliver the highest quality dispensary experience possible, consistency is part of that experience.
A retail outlet like HBRC not only has to deal with and adapt to challenging tax and regulatory structures, but also faces a very difficult competitive market when considering not only unpermitted operations within Humboldt, but also Humboldt's proximity to out-of-state operations.
California is a big state, so it's hard also, I feel like, to pass regulations that apply to every jurisdiction. An example of that is a policymaker in Sacramento may not realize that Humboldt County, Arcata in particular, that our dispensary is not that far from Oregon. Oregon's prices are much, much cheaper than California's prices. I have customers who will shop for product and tell me that's just simply cheaper in Oregon by 50% at times. We have a unique situation here in Humboldt County. We're competing against a different state with lower tax structures, far more outdoor harvested cannabis, lowering ultimately the price per pound.
Right.
And so the tax rate, I do feel like, is slowing down the success of the legalized retail dispensaries in the state of California, also because California has a robust history of buying and selling cannabis in the gray market. So most people still know somebody who they can access these products from. When we send out emails to the BCC, to the regulators, we often comment that your structure is leading people back to the black market. You know, we heard some local black market growers who would come in and comment, gosh, your prices are still so high. I think I need to turn my lights back on. And we're trying to say our prices are getting so low as far as the margin that we're obtaining on them that we're going to be turning in just to street retail like any other store, almost getting into restaurant margins eventually.
Despite all this, HPRC's Brian Wilcombe finds room for optimism and opportunity.
So retail has a lot of challenges, but I also want to always say you are selling cannabis, and that's a big change. So let's try to touch on the positive ends of things. You're able to sell cannabis in a safe, comfortable setting. This is not a drug deal in an alleyway anymore. You know, now we're talking about aesthetics of our facilities and the amenities that we can offer to the customer experience. So we're trying to stay positive on the side of retail. It is going to be highly competitive. You know, HPRC has been very supportive of the cannabis industry as a whole, and we're really excited to see other retail dispensaries open up. It is a difficult challenge that we're going to work through as far as the business side of things, but as a culture, and on the positive outlook for our community, we're excited that we're talking about regulating, we're opening up new businesses, we're going to learn hopefully from each other and develop a best practices through retail. Because we all have to coordinate too for tourism.
Tourism, that word comes up a lot in discussions of Humboldt's economic opportunities. Just how and how much to include cannabis in Humboldt's tourism marketing remains a subject of much debate around here. HPRC's Brian Wilcombe sees an opportunity, but believes some issues need to be resolved before a robust cannabis tourism market can develop.
One thing I think that was an issue in Colorado when I visited that is still an issue here in California is the issue of lounges, where to consume. So finding an appropriate consumption component to cannabis legalization, I think, is very important. I do think that the retail industry would greatly benefit from the ability to have tasting rooms. With price points being so high, it's hard for some of the recreational users to experiment with which products. This is a new industry to me. You know, when I go out to, let's say, Bittersweet locally, I'm able to get a 3-ounce taster instead of a 12-ounce. And these are the types of things that I think would have new employment opportunities, new business opportunities, and also get people, get rid of the ambiguity of where you can consume and how to consume and normalize that culture a little bit more. And with tourism too, we get a lot of tourists who are law-abiding tourists. So they'll come and they'll ask us, I got my product now, where can I go? And we tell them, well, nowhere. Don't smoke in your hotel, you're gonna get a fine. It's not legal to smoke in public. But I've had some conversations even with city council members who said, smoking a joint on the marsh, that actually might be a really therapeutic experience for the tourism component. Now, I have concerns, obviously, about drug driving, but there is more history of cannabis use, I think, than many acknowledge, and we can find a resolution to some of those issues. So if we're talking about increased public transportation with the increased tourism, these are all good things that benefit everybody.
And finally, even though Brian Wilcombe thinks it may be difficult for Humboldt County to compete with other areas on a price basis, other factors peculiar to Humboldt, he says, give us an advantage.
Well, I'll tell you that I went to two different states that had a Humboldt dispensary. Yeah, so I can tell you that our brand recognition is there. It's just how we empower ourselves to use that and what we're going to do with it. I truly think Humboldt County has the best cannabis products. Being someone who has traveled to just about every legalized state and explored cannabis options in those areas, California and Humboldt County in particular produces amazing products. The intellectual property that we have here, the knowledge to the certain processes for the certain cultivars that we grow, it really is outstanding. The question though comes down to is the consumer trend. If the consumer really just wants the most affordable product, are they going to make that choice to purchase Humboldt County versus something, say, $20, $15 an eighth? I just don't know. That's why I feel like the other asset that we have is our value of our natural components and ecotourism, bringing the consumer here, because that's one thing that'll benefit everyone. You know, the local restaurant needs the individual who's coming up here for ecotourism, in addition to cannabis purchasing, in addition to all the other services. I don't think that we should invest just into one industry because that the benefit is then not realized by the most community members. So that's kind of the idea, is we're trying to export Humboldt County products to be purchased in other areas, import humans to this area to stay, heads in beds, go out to restaurants, go out and eat, but hey, let's grab an HPRC joint before maybe you take your walk on the beach and explore the beauties that we have.
Our thanks to Brian Wilcombe at the Humboldt Patient Resource Center in Arcata. We're going to continue our discussion after a quick break. Coming up, we'll be visiting with the folks at Sisu Extracts. And among the things we're going to find out is what Sisu means. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Back in just a moment. Welcome back. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. We're going to explore another lane in the cannabis industry right now, the extract business. Think of an extract as a kind of concentrate produced from cannabis using a solvent, and it can be consumed in a variety of ways. Recently, Larry and I spent some time with the folks at Sisu Extracts here in Humboldt County, John Figueredo and Joe Wynn. The first thing we asked them, what does Sisu mean?
So I actually have it in my arm right here. My father is half Finnish, and so he grew up in a Finnish household. And Sisu is one of the terms that they had always used to persevere against all odds.
It's part of the Finnish national identity, and it doesn't translate fully to English, but it's basically grit under pressure, an unwillingness to quit, and it's like something you would say to someone in the moment of trial, where here we go, come on.
Yeah, and that's the community that we're in. We are all persevering against all odds in this Humboldt community.
given that, with Perseverance, they're positioning their company as one that solves problems for cultivators.
The main business focus of Sisu Extracts is to be a business solution for farmers. When I went into this business, I really thought that the best thing that we could do when I'm looking at a commodities marketplace is figuring out how we can be a business solution for the community. So an example is when we looked at the market, we basically saw that prices of flour were starting to drop and the prices of biomass were starting to go up, and we realized that we're reaching an equilibrium. Our operating assumption for the next 12 months is that we believe that the marketplace is going to turn to commodities pricing, to where the price of flour per milligram of THC and the price of biomass per milligram of THC will be almost the same price. And at that point, rather than spending hundreds of thousands of dollars every single year on your harvest process, your sales process, we can be an all-in-one business solution for farmers to be able to let them focus on being cultivators and then us do the rest.
Primarily, we manufacture distillate. So the product goes through an ethanol extraction process. We then remove the ethanol from that extract, and then it goes through a series of distillation machines that allow us to remove other constituent compounds, with our main goal being to end up between 88 and 93% total THC content. And then that oil is primarily used for filling the electronic vapor cartridges you've seen around the state, but it can also be used in smaller amounts for topicals and orals and edibles and drinks. It can be converted into a lot of different forms. It's similar if we were looking at the baking industry, we're making flour. This is the raw THC input for a large variety of products, but really the lion's share of that is vapor cartridges.
All of that, of course, makes perfect sense. Good ideas, understandable, but it does beg the question, why not choose the cultivation lane?
I think cultivation is the hardest job in the industry, right? They're tied into a biological cycle for anywhere from 3 to 6, 7 months where wind, rain, mold, squirrels, random people stopping by and alleviating you of your product, any one of those things can happen to you, and the ability to iterate and start over again is incredibly limited just by the seasonality of it. Sunk costs are incredibly high, regulatory is incredibly tough, like farmers are burdened with the hardest job in the industry right now, and the ability for us, when we're running machines, if we make a mistake here, we can clean out. The material's not destroyed, it's just in the wrong form, and we can start again within 45 minutes. We get the ability to iterate and learn faster, and so because we were able to do that for several years, we were able to master our craft quickly, whereas growers get one or two shots a year to master their craft. So that was one of the really nice things, is in this exploding industry, having the opportunity to learn to do our job faster was a major market advantage, and also the scalability of it. Farmers need acres on acres on acres, and we, with 10,000 square feet, can process hundreds of farms. So it just allowed us to put ourselves in a place in the market where we could bring a lot of value to local farmers and simultaneously have the opportunity to scale and keep pace with the industry, which I think is much harder to do in the cultivation realm.
Not that everything is easy for Sisu. It isn't. In fact, they have aggressive competition, especially from Los Angeles.
We see we call them raiding parties coming up from LA, and they come up and aggressively negotiate to get the lowest price they can. Because when you're in a buying relationship with a farm, it's an adversarial position where the lower the price you get the farmer to agree to, the more money you make on the backside. And because it's difficult to estimate the potency content of trim, because you only test 3 grams out of 50 pounds, it's very difficult to say what's actually in there. So buyers are incentivized to push the price as low as they possibly can on the off chance that the material is not high quality. They just have to shove the farmers down. So where our model becomes different is because we do a percentage split with farmers, we take in the material, produce the oil, sell the oil, and then split it, we're incentivized to take their material, make as much oil as we possibly can, sell it for as much as we possibly can, because we're living off of the smaller portion of the value stream they've created.
And we want to align incentives, because the best thing is if they win, we win. And we want to always be in that same team kind of position and be able to support the local community in that way.
A long time ago, splits were more dangerous because there was no enforceability to it. You'd let a guy walk out the door, he'd go do his thing, you'd never hear from him again, or he'd call you and say the numbers were this or that. You couldn't find him, like you just literally couldn't find where that man was physically located. Now we've got our address on our license and you can stop by anytime. You've got my cell phone number. So no, I would not say splits are entirely unique to us. I would say that they are less common. There's a significant trust factor that we have to have with our farms. They're making a bet on us, and it's our job to come through on that. And the pain points around that come when there's realities in the market. In the same way that farmers were gonna grow 100 pounds and sell them for 1,000, and by the time they're ready, they've got 93 pounds and the market's at 6. Mm-hmm. that's painful. We experience the same thing. We're going to have X number of machines on this day, and regulatory causes problems or other things stretch out timelines. And then we're also dependent on going to market with their material and selling it at a given price. As the market declines, my offer declines. But what we're working to do is to create a competitive offer so that regardless of market conditions, we will be offering more than the cash out price offered by those LA rating parties. Because in Humboldt County, there's like this big thing where everybody talks about they want to help farmers and they want to support our local cannabis farmers, but there's really not a better way to do that than giving them more money. And so where our model allowed us flexibility is it allowed us to bring in more material, which allowed us to scale and become more efficient, which allows us to give a bigger percentage to the farmer. And as long as we continue that cycle of growing our production efficiency and developing relationships with the agricultural community here, we'll become more efficient, we'll give them a bigger chunk of the pie, and we'll be able to offer them more money and support local farmers in a meaningful way that like makes a difference at that pay the mortgage level.
Something we often talk about on this program came up again in our discussions at CSU. Regulations in the cannabis industry compared to the regulatory environment in other agricultural arenas.
I think it's just a function of government. So one of the things is government by its very nature has to move slower. And given that we're so entrepreneurial and so fast paced in this economy, there is no way for the government's regulatory environment to catch up faster than the market changes. So an example is you could have hundreds of acres that would come online for cannabis before they could figure out the laws. So now we're in a state to where you've watched pretty decent market declines for the product of biomass and flower. But they've not been able to catch up with the cultivation taxes. They're not now trying to take them away. But if everyone had their say right now to protect everyone, you'd want to remove them immediately.
The other regulatory hamstringing that's going on out there is our farmers up here are limited to 10,000 square feet. It is madness to try to make a living off of an agricultural product on 10,000 square feet. Nobody's ever driven by a 10,000 square foot apple orchard or a 10,000 square foot tomato farm that was feeding multiple families. There are small examples of homestead farms producing a couple hogs a year, and they sell tomatoes at the local farmers market. And that's one thing, that's homestead agriculture, which is amazing and awesome, and communities have that. But when we're talking about statewide need for a product serving tens of millions of people, limiting Humboldt County farmers to these tiny farms, it's a stranglehold. They can't escape. And these southern farmers are looking at 40 and 160 acre permits being given out much easier, much faster, because they're coming from agricultural territory. And here we are in a mountainous area where farmers are being limited to these small spaces, and it prevents them from making the growth they need. As prices come down, the solution is grow more. And that also encourages prices to come further down. But if you don't even have that first move after prices come down, you can't grow more. You just watch your revenues drop year over year.
There is a silver lining to that. The silver lining is the fact that if you look at major agricultural areas, so places he's absolutely right in the fact that Santa Barbara was the first to really open that up to be giving 1 acre permits, which is 44,000 square feet instead of 10,000 square foot permits. But they come from an agricultural area that makes their pesticide limits be incredibly high. So the one silver lining for Humboldt that is really fantastic is the fact that we've got these unbelievably untouched agricultural areas that make some of the cleanest product in the world. So we don't see anything like it. As far, if you look at our fail rates for stuff that's coming out of Santa Barbara and Southern California, Salinas area versus Humboldt, night and day difference.
Yeah, Humboldt County, 90% pass rate ballpark, down south 50% or less.
And that gets us to the Humboldt brand and the issue of quality and premium Humboldt cannabis.
Humboldt brand will become more relevant as the distance from Humboldt increases, right? Weed from Humboldt isn't as special in San Francisco because they've been getting it forever. It's not that different. They get weed from LA or weed from Humboldt, and there's a small percentage of connoisseurs there who are really excited about that. One of the big things that'll come with federal legalization is folks in Kansas are going to be real excited to have access to Humboldt County cannabis for the first time knowingly. So then it'll be super relevant. And it's really, there's going to be three places in the world where the cannabis is special. I mean, there'll be a couple other pockets, but pretty much we're looking at like Amsterdam, Jamaica, and Humboldt County. These are the three places in the world that have major historical relevance in cannabis cultivation, like in the past 60 years. There's pros and cons. Yeah. But one of the pros of borders opening up is there will be people out there who are absolutely dying to get their hands on Humboldt County cannabis, in the same way that there's people in Texas who just swear by Napa Valley wines. There are craft cultivators up here who I believe absolutely are producing the finest outdoor grown cannabis in the world. Like, I think that's a real thing. I think there's very few other places where the level of attention to detail and generational knowledge has continued to grow wholesale cannabis for years and years and years with access to first world resources. Like, that's a major difference.
You've got very unique genetics that have been grown here. A lot of people that have a lot of experience in that. So if you were to, let's say this is analogous to the alcohol industry, you have people that are going to create Grey Goose, and then you have people, and Johnnie Walker Blue Label, and you have people that are going to create Anheuser-Busch, you know, Natural Ice or something like that, or Budweiser. So when Kansas opens up, their goal is to create Bud Light. And Humboldt County will need to continue doing high quality cannabis to be more of that Johnnie Walker Blue Label or Grey Goose or high end brands that people really enjoy, or a microbrewery, for example.
So you think that a premium pricing model is important for Humboldt County producers?
It's everything that comes with that. It's not just setting the pricing. It's effectively doing the job of telling people that it's better and it's special, right? Like the truth is, if I pour you two glasses of wine, one that's a $100 bottle from Napa and one that's a bottle of $2 Chuck, the vast majority of the population can't really tell the difference. The difference is you read about one in a magazine, you saw somebody who you admire their opinion saying that this is a superior product, and it's been present on the market for years and has that established value, that all of those jobs must be done in, you know, congruently in order for that to be achieved. It's not just produce a better product. You also must tell the story of your product in a convincing way that causes people to see an enhanced value in your product. Because truthfully, we're comparing dried flowers to dried flowers. And once you exhale, it's all very, very much the same. So that you have to both create a better quality product and convince people that it is a better quality product because it is from here.
So far, so good for Sisu. And with success comes a ripple effect in the form of local job creation.
It was just me, Joe, and Shannon and my wife working here for the first few months. And now we've scaled from 4 people to close to 50 at this point. And we've done that within around 120 days. And we just got so lucky to have wonderful teammates here that have been able to scale at the pace with us. It has not been easy. We have our facility works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we have people working all around the clock in the manufacturing facility. We have our sales team. We have our supply chain team. We have human resources. We have multiple departments, and it's scaling all across the state.
A question that does arise, though, is this. Will Sisu be able to remain in Humboldt County, or will they have to move closer to customers in larger population centers?
I had a different operating assumption when I started. I was like, oh gosh, I'll probably have to go down to LA and do all of that stuff. But the wonderful thing about this business is we take a product that's actually more difficult to move, and we're in the heart of the cleanest, best product in the United States right now and where most of it is produced. And so up until this year, probably 60% of all cannabis grown was grown in Humboldt County. And so we're right in the middle of that feedstock, and then we distill down that feedstock into distillate. And that then becomes such a small product, it's very easy to ship anywhere. So having our headquarters here is actually incredibly advantageous.
You got to put the cotton gin in the middle of the cotton fields. Yeah. And with the pesticide regulations being what there are, here's the battleground where we stand the best chance of finding work that we can actually work on. And so we will have to market our materials down there. We will have to distribute down there because that's where the population centers are. Like very flatly, Humboldt County is growing enough cannabis for tens of millions of people.
The very nature of entrepreneurship means that there's at least some uncertainty about the future. New industries, new businesses, new markets, which can lead to loss of sleep.
What keeps me up at night, it's knowing that prices are going down, and that will be the historical trend until price equals cost. Like that must continue. It will come to be at parity with every other market in the world. And then the question that Humboldt farmers gotta talk to themselves about is, what is my actual cost, and what does that mean about how long I stay in? And I've got a lot of friends out there who've contributed to my career who I want to see know their numbers well and make smart decisions about when to double down and when to call it a day.
And there will be changes that will occur as well. So for instance, we're going to get a bunch of little breaths of a relief over time. So an example is a new technology that comes out that makes farming easier, that they pull over from industrial agriculture, or them changing the laws on cultivation tax that's going to save everyone 20%. So then you have that immediate 20% bump because of what the product's selling at. But when you go down to where the price of this is going to be $80 or $90, that's almost a 50% effective tax rate.
The tough news for folks out there is that prices are going to continue to get tougher. And what we're trying to do here is to build a model that will allow farmers a place to drop off one of their problems and forget about it. They've got this waste material that they can't convert into a sellable good for consumers. And if we give them a place where they can bring that, and then we are on the hook to fight for them for the best price, because that's how we feed ourselves. We make more money for them, we make more money for us. When we can provide that to Humboldt County farmers, then we can contribute back to the community that has allowed us to grow this business. We're not able to do this because we're special. We're able to do this because Humboldt County farmers trust us with their input materials. And the very best way that we can support them is work like hell to put more money in their pocket. We all go through bumps in the road. They're fighting the water board. You know, we're struggling with the building department. They're fighting weather. I'm dealing with gaskets that blow out. We're all worried about driving things up and down the highway. We're all facing very similar bumps along the road. And the main thing we're trying to do here is support that.
Our thanks to the folks at Sisu Extracts for taking the time to talk with us. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Coming up next, a local company that is carving out a lane for itself in the cannabis industry that has to do with, among other things, pain relief. And there is a dog involved. If you're a dog lover, you're going to like this story. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. Now to the Eureka offices of Papa & Barclay, another company navigating its way in the new cannabis industry with a funny name and products like balms, patches, body oils, tinctures, soaks. Recently, Larry and I talked with co-founder Guy Rocourt. Papa & Barclay formed in the fall of 2015 in Los Angeles, but jumped at the opportunity to relocate to Humboldt County.
Early 2016, John O'Connor, who's our compliance officer, was here doing the tourism center in Humboldt and was like, hey, you know, Humboldt is really starting to think about how they're going to deal with medical cannabis. And at that time, we did not have the Adult Use Act. And I was like, really? The opportunity to come in the Umber Triangle? It's like, that's awesome. That's where cannabis comes from. Let's do that. And so we immediately made the move to get the first facility here in Eureka on 4th Street, which we then subsequently purchased and have plans to build a bigger building there.
So who's Papa and who's Barclay?
So Papa & Barclay comes from our origin story. My partner, Adam Grossman, his dad was on hospice back in, I think, 2014. And they were like, if he doesn't get out of bed, he's probably going to pass away because he hadn't been out of bed in 2 weeks. And out of desperation, nothing was working. Adam called some folks here in California and they're like, well, maybe you should try to make a cannabis-based type balm. And he went out and purchased, you know, flowers off the streets of Boston and soaked them in coconut oil and rubbed that on his dad's back. And sure enough, his dad got out of bed, lived for several years after. He's since passed on, but that's Papa. And Barclay was Adam's dog who would come up to Boston with him from New York and eventually bonded with his dad and then just stayed in bed with his dad, keeping his dad warm, and was that dog. And so that was the name of the company. And of course, when we first started, you know, Adam was like, oh, well, should we call it Papa & Barclay? He was like really insecure because it was so personal. But everybody was like, this is amazing. Like, you know, a real origin story. I had already started a cannabis company in Denver. So I was already used to bringing a company into a compliant nature with Metric and all this stuff. And I saw his formula and I was like, yeah, you know, I have some experience with topicals, but let me do what you did and send it out for testing. Immediately doing that, I realized that he inadvertently fell into how strong topicals need to be. Topicals in general are not psychoactive, right? So we shouldn't fear how much THC is in them. But before, in the black market or gray market dispensaries, they were kind of like a Me Too product. They were an after product that, you know, a grower might do with their trim, and they were woefully underpowered. The fact is you need a certain level of THC to be an acute pain manager, but once you're in that threshold, it works. Like, you put it on, you have tennis elbow, you have arthritis, you use it, and you know, within 15 minutes, you're like, oh, that feels better. And that was we really understood that based on the origin story, like, oh, this is how strong we need to start. So we did some testing. We also did some tests using like CO2 extract oil and traditional extracted oils and realized that soaking the plant directly and doing what's called a direct lipid infusion, where it not only draws out the cannabinoids, it also draws out the green matter and the plant fats. That's why our balm is green, is also, there's something there. Like, there's something more magical, literally, then if I just use like a CO2 extract, sure, it has the API in there, but it just wasn't resonating the same way when we were doing some initial tests. Now, these are by no means like full-on clinical trials, right? This is all anecdotal evidence when we were first starting the company early in 2016. And so we settled on doing the lipid infusion and making the balm, you know, and having this great origin story. We released this hero product. Sure enough, people, you know, we call it the tip of the spear, because like, if you're not used to cannabis and you've seen the downside of it, and especially in this community, and I give you this product that, especially as an older person, you're like, amazing, right? And there is no psychoactive component. It really highlights the wellness potential of cannabis.
Interesting thing about emerging markets. Sometimes you get a surprise in the form of unexpected responses to a particular product.
We released a bath soak, which at first I thought was a luxury product, but people with diabetic neuropathy, when their feet like swell, they soak it in this bath soak that has 150 milligrams of THC in the jar. And people were like giving us emails like, I haven't felt my feet in 15 years. This is amazing, right? And then subsequently, somewhat because of the CBD craze, we released a second balm that's rich in CBD. It has 400 milligrams of CBD, but we also went ahead and put 150 milligrams of THC in the 2 ounce jar because that's where I think the acute threshold for pain management is. So you can use it, get some immediate efficacy, but more CBD is the way it really works, regardless of what's going out in the marketplace, is it wants to be in your fat cells and it prevents inflammation, right? It stops that precursor that your body sends for inflammation, which is why it's super good for autoimmune diseases, right? Because as it protects your the fat around your myelin sheath, it also resets and prevents your autoimmune responses from attacking themselves. That's why we see such good results for people with epilepsy, people with Crohn's, people with MS, all those neurodegenerative or autoimmune diseases where your body's attacking its myelin sheath or attacking itself. That's why CBD shines, right? That's what it's good for, but that's usually when it's taken internally. And of course, now we know that for some reason, the skincare industry thinks it's the next big API. I say that, and we are involved in an actual clinical trial using CBD to see if it will work as a puffiness thing around, like as an ice serum. So we are developing that product. We also are developing a CBD lotion, and that's just for our 50 state thing, but then we will bring those formulations back and, you know, probably do a lotion with THC.
For the most part, the Papa and Barclay brand is non-psychoactive for most people.
I've been advocating in cannabis for 20 years. I don't fear psychoactivity. We don't say that about opiates. We don't say that about Xanax. We don't say that about Percocet. It's about dosing. It's about education. So I don't fear psychoactivity and I don't want to disparage it. That being said, it has been helpful that our brand for the most part is non-psychoactive. The balm is non-psychoactive. The patches are non-psychoactive for most people. But the tinctures, for sure. Our CBD tincture, no. Because it's, you know, 30-1 and has very minimal THC in it. But our 3-1 is, you know, 22 milligrams of THC in a dropper, and it is very real. Our 1-1 tincture is made with THCA, which has been shown to have the same analgesical benefits, but limited psychoactivity. So that's, you know, 15 milligrams of THCA and 15 milligrams of CBD, but it does have the potential to be psychoactive. And then, of course, the capsules, the CBD ones, not so much, but the THC-rich capsules are a real analgesic. Like all analgesics, it should be noted, people always skip over this, before you feel the euphoric or psychoactive effects, pain management is in there somewhere, right? So our capsules are very popular for people that are going through chemo, right? Because chemo is this weird thing where we've failed cancer patients, right? You go to chemo and it's destroying the cancer, but also destroying your body. Then they prescribe you some kind of Norco, which is not an anti-nausea. And more importantly, by a week, now you're constipated and can no longer eat. And now you're not regenerating. So you're getting attacked and not getting any nutrition to build your body back up. Whereas the minute you introduce cannabis, not only do you get the pain management, you also get the anti-nausea effect and the appetite increase. And now all of a sudden you're feeling better, eating more, and you're able to maintain the rest of your function while the chemo does what it's supposed to do and attack the cancer, right? And it's so obvious, and we've seen such success that it's like how the rest of the nation is just not doing this right now is mind-boggling. And so whenever we get an email or whenever somebody's like, oh, somebody's going through chemo and they don't have access to, you know, a good THC tincture or capsule, that needs to be fixed, because that could be a difference in them making it and not, for sure.
Among the keys to understanding the Papa and Barclay story in Humboldt is growth. It is happening, and there's more on the way for them.
When we started here in California, we estimated that the wellness market was about 3%, and we do take some pleasure in thinking that we helped grow it to about what is now 10%. And the reason for that is most people that come into cannabis, that are coming into dispensaries now, are looking for a wellness product. What we've been able to do is create a suite of products that is accessible to new cannabis users. As we grew the marketplace, we grew, right? We have grown exponentially. While we started just as a manufacturer trying to make these cool little products, we ended up moving here, and we started a grow, but then realized, you know what? There's a lot of small farmers. They're gonna try to figure this out. We don't need to start another small farm. Let's partner with these local farmers. We're partnering with about 50 farmers around the Emerald Triangle. Then we started seeing other people doing distribution, totally messing it up. So we started P&B Logistics. We now are in 85% of the dispensaries that are licensed. We made the decision right at 2018 to only go to licensed dispensaries. And to give you a sense from a business standpoint, what that meant was we were in about 700 dispensaries at the time. and only and went to 90 from December to January, dropped down to 90 dispensaries because only 90 people had licenses, right? Now that's grown and we're back, but we have grown the marketplace and we grew from 20 people and now we're 65 people here just on the manufacturing, right? Just in Eureka.
With an eye toward future growth, Papa and Barkley recently acquired the empty Kmart shell on the south side of Eureka. In talking about plans for that facility, you'll hear Guy refer to GMP compliance, good manufacturing practice.
The Kmart represents a next blank slate. Typical consumer products and definitely typical OTC are required to do things like, you know, GMP certification and those kinds of high-level manufacturing standards. And so that's what the Kmart represents. We will definitely be building that Kmart to be a GMP compliant facility so that when and if those regulations are layered on to cannabis manufacturing products, we'll be ready, right? So it's a future-proofing method because eventually we do want to be in Walmart. We want to be in CVS, right? And so we want to be able to show these retailers that we are producing at the top level, you know, just like Tylenol or just like any other OTC with all those right SOPs and all the right compartmentalization of our processes and so on. And so that's what the Kmart looks like. Right now we're using it as just our big distro hub because I, you know, as a products maker, I only think about making the products. I don't think about, oh, you need lots of square footage for the empty packaging and even more square footage for the filled goods, you know, in your backstock situation. So we are activating in the Kmart right now. And we've had Pearson, another local company, build out a box in there that the city has shown us a way to make it compliant where we can just do distribution there for now. And then actually around the perimeter, we'll build a permanent distribution facility. Those guys will move in there. And then the main center floor of it will start to get carved up. And I have actually a GMP consultant coming tomorrow so that we can start to understand like how do we lay it out effectively and make great flow through for making these kinds of products.
Of course, where a company locates, where it works, is a choice. And for Papa and Barkley, it does seem to mean a lot to them to be tethered to Humboldt County, and they say they want to make a difference here.
This community deserves to reap the benefits of cannabis. That's just that simple. And when you go to Napa, when you go to Sonoma and you see what wine country is like, you just see the slightly better schools, slightly better roads, slightly more affluent communities. That needs to come here. Those tax dollars needs to come here. When I first came here, I was surprised by how awesome the food in Eureka is, right? I also thought it was kind of cool that every time I went to a nice restaurant, I wasn't the only bearded person wearing a hoodie. I was like, all right, cool. I also wasn't the only person paying cash. Okay. There's a lot of revenue that's been generated here that just hasn't made its way to the community, right? And so it's very important for us at Papa and Barkley to bring that, right? So we're building the company, sure. And in a way, building a cannabis company is a little bit easier. If we were in beer or if we were in fashion or any of these other saturated markets, it'd be all we focus on is making the business. But we have a marketplace opening up under us. So yeah, we're going to make money. We're going to grow our business. But more importantly, we should be cognizant that we're building an industry, right? We're literally building the shelf that our products are on. We're literally having thought leadership around those things. And why not here? Why not make the heart of Humboldt, you know, really shine in what it's always been doing? It's already in the laws that there's an appellation, but our ultimate goal is to source everything and manufacture everything right here in Humboldt and so that it can have that appellation. And everything we do, just as a rule, we have a 10% cap, right? So if we could source something in San Francisco or somewhere else and it's 10% more locally, it's gonna be done locally. A good example of that, we're building this cold room. I could have went and purchased that from Webster & Co. like I did my first freezer and saved, you know, whatever, $20,000, but I went to Town & Country. That's what they do. They do refrigeration. They'll install our entire cold room. There'll also be maintenance, and I also owe those guys for, you know, I had $500,000 in fresh frozen product in my one freezer, and the freezer decided to crap out and everybody started freaking. They showed up in the middle of the night, fixed my freezer, and so I recognize that. So yeah, as much as we can do locally is always the key.
If the cannabis industry were to be federally legalized, you have to wonder if a company like Papa and Barkley would elect to stay in Humboldt County. Would national expansion affect their commitment to Humboldt County?
So if it was up to us, and I know I speak for my partners and our investors, even though we may have to start a facility in Denver, potentially start a facility in Nevada while we have this artificial federal restriction, when that does drop, we would build more facilities here in the county, if not in the city of Eureka, to do our national expansion. If I had to visualize a dream, there would be a Made in Humboldt sign on our products, and that product would be distributed throughout the state. You know, the whole way cannabis has been made here has basically been a grassroots, no pun intended, movement of people going out and being brand ambassadors for the cannabis that comes from Humboldt. Even as a grower in LA, I used to fret when, you know, the sun grown would come down in November when what we call the flood, and it would disturb my personal economics. You know, okay, whatever. But that's, you know, this is where cannabis comes from. There's a long culture here, and yeah, we want to grow that.
Currently, the marketing of Humboldt County is a hot topic in the seats of power, most saying yes to marketing redwoods and beaches and mountains, but some not wanting the association with cannabis. But with the economic potential of this new industry, some of the folks at Papa and Barkley wonder why you would not be trumpeting the quality of Humboldt County cannabis products.
We need to be cognizant as a community that marketing doesn't happen in a vacuum and unfortunately takes lots of resources. So my experience here in the city of Eureka and the county is that there's still some changing that needs to be communicated, and we need to move hands to sign checks, and the county should be wise to start to have some investment budget to advertise itself, right? Now, I know that's a larger conversation. There are probably some people that feel that cannabis shouldn't be associated with Humboldt, period, right? And they're sitting in seats of power right now, and we just need to wait it out, figure it out, convince them. I don't know what the right answer is, but if it was up to me, I would think that the county should be investing in cannabis, in understanding that we have this appellation in the law, right? The concept of cannabis tourism, the concept of like encouraging cannabis business as a sustainable industry, unlike logging, unlike fishing. This is pretty sustainable and is here. You know, the number keeps going up. It used to be like 5 billion, 6 billion. Now it's $1 trillion marketplace. You know, and we have the opportunity to be like champagne in France. If you have the opportunity to be like a name, a physical name in a $1 trillion marketplace, it's like, how do you not go after that? Hopefully, first here at the city of Eureka, then by the county at large, we'll start to have people on the Economic Planning Commission that are willing to put taxpayers' dollars to advertising and encouraging people to come and visit. And more importantly, on the biz dev side, how about we get some of that money and help these small farmers fix their watershed, provide some loans for small farmers to build the infrastructure they need to be compliant, right? Those things would be where I would invest, you know, but I understand that it's a larger conversation at the county level.
This brand new emerging industry certainly presents its share of challenges, but it also presents some opportunities, like the chance to get the business culture right from the get-go.
I am blessed to be in the cannabis industry because it's a marketplace that's growing around me. I saw it happen in Colorado. Here it's to another level, right? So all that we need to be successful is just execute. But what is really important to me is securing cannabis culture, which its heart is here. We have an opportunity, a single moment in time, to solidify cannabis culture. When federal prohibition does fall, when these pharma companies and tobacco companies start looking to roll big brands up like us, we should have done our work and established cannabis culture in a way that is permanent and reverberates throughout the nation. And it's not just about the products we make, it's about how we treat our employees, how we treat small farmers, right? A lot of the things that tobacco and alcohol just blatantly did not do, we should be doing proactively right now. That's what's most important. Interestingly enough, I'm not that worried about building successful business. That's kind of happening because the marketplace is growing. What I'm focused on is building the kind of business I've always wanted, the kind of business that we should have always been building in America, right? California cannabis culture has always been part green movement, right? I don't want to say the word hippie, but like, yeah, there's some real open-minded, free-thinking elements that have always been attached to cannabis. And it's important for me that those get laid into our companies right now so that when federal prohibition falls, we can bring that to the rest of the nation. So while we export cannabis, I want to export a greener, better mindset. That's what I'm mostly focused on, honestly.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted soon at 941lounge.com, lostcoastoutpost.com, and at iTunes for listening and downloading. Thanks again to those who make this program possible: Humboldt Patient Resource Center, Satori Wellness, Eco Groovy Deals, Sensi Valley, and the Humboldt County Collective. We'll be back with the Humboldt Chronicles on the third Wednesday of each month. So we'll see you next time at 6 p.m. on March 20th.